Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Laura Rantz. For our first show of 2020, we've assembled our Between the Rows regular hosts and commentators for a special look back at the year that was and forward to the year that's coming. Joining me for a roundtable discussion is Dave Bedard, Glacier Farm Media's daily news editor, Gord Gilmore, editor of the Manitoba Cooperator, Ed White of the Western Producer, Robert Arneson, who also writes for the Western Producer, and Bruce Burnett, director of weather and markets information for Glacier Farm Media. As we prepared for this show, we thought it would be interesting to pull together all of the hosts, in fact, who work on this show over the course of the year, to talk about 2019, the year that was, and how that's positioning agriculture for the year that's coming, 2020. And when I started to prepare for this, for me, one of the trigger points in terms of 2019 being a very unusual year in agriculture was going back to December of 2018 with the arrest of the Huawei executive, Meng Wanzhou. That really seemed to set the stage for a whole cascade of events. And it was followed up by a lot of trade issues. We're still dealing with the Trump effect on our markets. We're dealing with weather in 2019. And we now have elections and a minority government in Ottawa. So, Gord, I'm going to start with you. And just, you know, when you look back at 2019, what were a couple of the things that really stuck out for you in the year?
Well, I think trade, absolutely. I think that was one of the big stories. And it's going to continue to be one of the big stories for years to come. I think that we talked about this last year, and I'm still convinced of it. We're probably looking at the end of the global free trade era. Not that it's going to go back to nobody's trading at all, but I don't think that we're seeing the same political appetite to pursue these big trade deals. You know, you see Brexit, we just had the vote there, and that was a pretty resounding endorsement of the direction they're taking. The NAFTA renegotiation, you know, if you don't have the Americans in a leadership position, it's difficult to drive this forward. We're going to be in an era where it's just going to be every man, woman, and country for themselves, I think. And then the second big thing that I saw this year, of course, was the weather. And here in Manitoba, we had the ironic 1-2 punch of a drought for most of the season and then terribly wet conditions for harvest. And that really was driving almost everything here in the province agriculturally.
Ed White?
Yeah, you know, I'd describe 2019 as a year of really grave disappointment, which sounds like a glum way to come into the new year. But if you look on ground after ground, we left 2018 with high hopes of building trade with China to break us from our over-reliance on the United States. And NAFTA had been resolved. There was lots of hopes there. And then, of course, Meng Wanzhou, as you've both mentioned. And that added on top of disappointments with the Canada-EU trade deal not really working out to any kind of gains for Canada so far. And then, you know, as Gord was just saying, the terrible weather problems on top of very uninspiring prices, marginal returns, a terrible harvest, you know, carbon taxes coming in and just adding a little bit of stress, especially on the grain drying at the end of the year. So it's really hard when I was thinking of this to find much to think, well, that was a really good development this year that, you know, farmers were happy about everywhere. It just seemed like a year of a lot of disappointments.
Mm-hmm. In other words, 2020 is going to get better because it can't get much worse.
Well, you know, things do tend to revert to the median, right? So I think we got to count on that. Remember in the equity markets last year, we all thought we were going to hell at the end of 2018. It was a giant recession and depression coming, and nope, it's been an awesome year. So let's hope for 2020 the same thing.
Robert.
I guess one thing that really stuck out for me was we've been talking about soil health for a while now in agriculture, and the phrase regenerative agriculture really caught on in 2019. I just went through some of the archives, and you know, I wrote multiple stories about this. I think the New York Times did a massive feature story on this trend, and I guess, you know, obviously this is gaining some momentum. What I'm curious about watching in, you know, 2020 and then next couple of years is, do prairie farmers actually really latch onto this? Do they want cover crops? Do they want to do intercropping? Do they want to really focus on these new techniques or not? And for me, that's a real, I guess, curiosity personally to see if this trend actually, you know, moves beyond hundreds of farmers to thousands. And I think that's a real interest, something to watch in the next couple of years.
I think we're going to come back to that question in a few minutes because that's been on my mind too. But let's go to you, Bruce Burnett.
Well, obviously there were problems in Western Canada and Eastern Canada with weather this year. So that's probably top of the list here as well. There were also some problems in other parts of the globe. We're seeing some continued droughts in Australia. This is the third year in a row that they've been hit. Very extensive drought in southern half of Africa. So we are seeing, again, some climate impacts that will filter themselves into the market. But I think the biggest market factor here that we haven't discussed yet is ASF in China and its impact on the hog herd there. And when you go back to it, that's the source of so much grain demand, both internally in China as well as products that they import, that really did have a huge impact this year. It did allow them, I think, to get through this trade war without purchasing a significant amount of U.S. soybeans. So that was one of the factors, I think, in the markets over this past year that people think about, but basically still has yet to play out, I think, in the long-term structure of global trade.
Dave Bedard?
Apart from the points that have already been touched on, of course, Ed had mentioned sort of the disappointments in some of the things that were sort of very that were the source of a lot of hand wringing over the course of the year. Of course, there was the launch of the cannabis industry in Canada, which also turned out to be rather a bust. You know, there haven't been a lot of people who've been able to capitalize off of that, and the companies that have made a splash in a big way have been posting rather underwhelming results. Like Bruce said, swine fever as well, that's been an issue. There's the CN rail strike, I thought, was an interesting one. Apart from the 8 days of lost time, which nobody could really afford to lose, it's going to be interesting, I think, for how it informs the next rail labor dispute, whenever that might be. And as far as any of the other sort of market disappointments that have come out of the past year, the plant-based burger industry, again, it's been something that a lot of people have been talking about it. I don't know if this necessarily anything that beef producers need to get defensive about. After I tried the Beyond Meat burger, I became a lot less sure that this segment is going to be a major game changer.
So, you know, when you look at all of those things that have really kind of come to a head in 2019, I mean, we've had industry trends like the plant-based movement. We've had the trade issues, really almost a complete collapse of the world trade order. You know, there's still mechanisms in place, but they're not functioning all that well. We're still dealing with Donald Trump, although he's got some issues at home that may or may not go in his favor. And when you put all that together, we now also have a minority government in Ottawa. And there's two ways of looking at that. Is this going to force the politicians to work together and come up with a cohesive strategy? Or do you see this as something that could actually hamstring the government in terms of being able to meet the industry's needs in this period of time? Who wants to go first?
Well, this is Robert here. What I've been noticing is there's been sort of like growing resentment, hostility in Western Canada. Obviously, we had the whole reaction post-election and all the talk of Western separation. But I guess just specific to the farm community, there's been so many issues that have been sort of coming up, from the carbon tax to sort of, I guess, some resentment about these non-meat burgers, right? And of course, feeling alienated from Ottawa. And then of course, you have these trade issues. All these things are sort of adding up, and I sort of wondering, okay, when something else happens in 2020, are we going to see like massive farm protests? Are we going to see like more anger? Like, what's going to be the reaction of the farm community? Because I think people are kind of tired, exhausted, frustrated, and there could be potentially quite a strong reaction if something goes against the agricultural community early in the new year.
I know, Bruce, you mentioned after coming back from some meetings in Alberta that people were really almost looking for a different approach.
Yes, like, I mean, certainly this harvest, especially across most of the grain belt, it was a very significant negative in terms of crop quality. A lot of crops still left out in the fields, and markets didn't seem to respond to this reality. Grain drying costs going up at the same time. So I think there is an appetite out there for trying to do something else. My concern for looking forward to next year is just given that we do have most of the eastern prairies in a very wet situation, that any snowfall this winter is going to result in spring flooding in those areas. And so farmers are going to have to adapt there as well. So we're going to have to see a lot of adaptation, I think, in the upcoming year, just in order to get this crop into the ground.
Well, there's a lot of crop left over to get off the fields before they can even get into the next year, right?
Yes, that's right. And you know, it's the same thing on my brother's farm. We've got most of our canola out overwintering this year. So it's going to be the first time, you know, since we started farming there in the 30s that this has ever happened. So these are exceptional events. Again, that is not just in one isolated part of the prairies. It's across most of the northern grain belt and central grain belt of the prairies that we did see these harvest issues.
So we're all in this together.
Basically, yes. That's the difference this year is that the challenging conditions didn't impact just one small area. It impacted a very large area of the prairies.
Ed, just shifting to the national scene, again, I mean, minority government, positive, negative, too soon to say?
Yeah, I guess it depends if you like seeing government trying to do stuff or if you want government to stay out of the way. And I suppose they could do those incremental things for farmers, those small things, which often people like seeing, rather than big, bold, new initiatives. So that could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on what you want the role of government to be. But, I mean, really, in a way, with the kind of grindingly low profitability now and the production problems and the trade issues hanging over the heads of farmers in agriculture, I mean, really, how much can government do? We often think government can do something that will have a big major effect, but really what farmers need is higher prices and decent crops for a couple of years to make up for a couple of years of bad crops and bad prices. And really everything else we argue about, whether it's carbon taxes or, you know, the CN strike, those sorts of things, we think that that's maybe what's causing problems for farmers. And while those exacerbate things, I mean, really, unless you can get, you know, decent crops and prices that can pencil out a profit, things are going to seem grim.
Or significantly reduce your costs.
Yeah, if you can find some way, and you don't have too much debt hanging over your head, which is fixed, if you can find some way to minimize risk and minimize cost and eke through until there's some sort of a higher level of price structure, it's a time of getting by, not getting ahead.
Gord Gilmore?
I would definitely agree with Ed. We're back to the cost-price squeeze that reasserts itself every so often. In terms of politically, I guess maybe I'm seeing things more from the Manitoba perspective than some of my colleagues who work for the larger regional publications, in that I don't see producers locally, they're not in love with the federal government, I would certainly say that, but we've seen here provincially our provincial progressive conservative premier has had no appetite to engage in the Wexit talk. He's just not interested in it one little bit. And I'm sensing much the same from most of the farmers I talk to. They're more interested in bread and butter issues. And to be honest, the most political kind of upheaval I see is actually at the provincial level, We have cattle producers here who are very upset about some changes to Crown lands that have been brought through by the current Progressive Conservative government. I'm expecting that to continue on. So I think that'll be where the political give and take is going to be for the Manitoba farmer this year.
Dave Bedard?
Getting back to Ed's point about there being only so much government can do, the one thing that I found kind of fascinating, and perhaps the election of a minority government will help dial this down somewhat. When the China issue first broke, you know, there was this level of partisan sniping on social media that got very tedious very fast, you know, as if this movie would have played out any differently with any other party in power. You know, I remember I got a chance this spring to talk briefly to a few critics from the federal Conservatives shadow cabinet when they were in town. You know, maybe I've just become sort of weary of platitudes, and I was really pleased to see that they had concrete ideas for Canada to push back. You know, whether those ideas would work is debatable. I mean, is a WTO complaint going to work when the whole dispute process is stuck in limbo for a lack of appeal judges?
And it takes years, even if it is working.
Exactly. You know, there was some suggestion that we could cut the funding that Canada has committed to the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. You know, will the Chinese government even notice? is the Canadian economy even up for, you know, sort of a trade war of the scale we're seeing in the States? And on top of that, I mean, we're not, you know, when we talk about, you know, sort of the reordering of global trade, no, we're not even playing by the same rule book as China. Is further antagonizing China a good idea at all when they've got Canadian citizens detained over this whole issue?
When you look at this big picture and you know, it's kind of like a perfect storm on steroids. I mean, there's so many things coming at farmers right now, from the political, the international landscape, and from the weather. It becomes a question of what do you do? And I think this is where I wanted come back to Robert's comment about regenerative agriculture. And I think that that's an evolving term, and there's a lot of people trying to stake out some ownership of that term, everything from people that would like to have it include not using some of the modern technologies to people that are really looking at it from the perspective of soil health. And I guess what I'm wondering, and I'll just throw this out there for your comments, is whether we're reaching a tipping point in terms of the producer's mind in agriculture, and in terms of all of the things that they can't control. The one thing they can't control is they're on the farm and their production risk, and whether there are some of these strategies out there, like the regenerative principles in terms of focusing on soil health, focusing on cover crops, trying to reduce your costs through using fewer inputs, whether you're seeing that really kind of continuing to grow in people's minds, and whether that's even an option for people in terms of managing their way through this. I'll throw that out to you first, Robert, because you brought it up.
Yeah, well, one trip I did take this summer is I took a crop tour through southwest Manitoba and in southeastern Saskatchewan. And this was in the middle of summer, and what became very noticeable, especially like in the Weyburn area, is that there was a lot less canola around. So producers there were quickly responding to the market realities, and a lot of them were planting flax. So, you know, obviously everybody knows flax is not a high-yielding crop, and sometimes it's difficult to grow. But it seems to me that there are growers that are desperately seeking an alternative to canola. So I'm thinking that we could see a bump up in some of the acres of these so-called alternative crops, such things like camelina, maybe more faba beans. You might see producers more willing to experiment with something new because canola is not working. Canola is an expensive crop to grow. And therefore, they say, well, maybe I should try a couple hundred acres of X and see how this works on my farm. And maybe we'll see a bump up in some of these acreage of these, I guess, so-called, you know, lesser crops, right?
Mm-hmm. Dave Bedard, let's throw it over to you first.
Well, I haven't got too much to add on that topic. Although the one thing, as far as reduction of inputs is concerned, you know, farmers may also find themselves a little more wary now. There's a lot of the tools that they have been using are coming under increased pressure as well. Glyphosate, for instance, is coming under pressure from our export customers in the EU, for instance. Neonicotinoids, of course, we're still waiting to see in the next couple of months how that's going to play out at the federal level. I think, to some extent, as far as farmers' use of inputs, I mean, there's going to have to be some changes there because there may not be much of a choice.
Gord.
Well, I think what we're looking at is, if I could boil it down to a phrase, cost containment. And we've seen that before. We have these periods in agriculture where we have high prices, and my old editor, Tom Button at Country Guide, always said the problem with periods of high prices is while they're wonderful, they also sort of paper over a lot of management decisions you might not otherwise make. So I think that... Well, I don't want to downplay the hard times individual farms are going to go through. I think as an industry and as a sector, this will sort of enforce some discipline, and this will make people reconsider what they've been doing, and they'll come up with management strategies that are going to be successful. It won't be easy. It won't be simple. I think probably you're right that the regenerative agriculture is the path that I see developing most quickly and most fully. But we've seen it before. We've seen the adoption of continuous cropping and doing away with summer fall. We've seen the adoption of minimum tillage and all of these things. These were all primarily a response to, they started out as being a conservation-based thing, but they were adopted primarily as a response to hard economic times. And we will see the same sort of evolution here. What it's going to look like in the end, well, I don't have a crystal ball to say for sure that. But I do think that the regenerative agriculture path is one that I see a lot of farmers looking down, heading down, developing interest in.
Ed White?
Yeah, I think a lot of the interest we're seeing now at all the conferences I go, people are always bringing up things like intercropping. And it's not for, you know, what some people might think of as flaky reasons. It's as a way to go to maybe a kind of a lower investment and lower risk type of farming, where maybe you don't need as much in terms of inputs. There's less risk to the crop itself, less market risk if someone can figure out a way to do it on a commercial basis and in a bigger way. Because, you know, farmers in certainly across Western Canada are caught in a very, very high level of investment agriculture, very high capital agriculture, because we don't have access to labor really much at all. You can get a few workers maybe if you're lucky, but we don't have what a lot of the world has, which is lots of cheap labor. So we have to go to a lot of highly expensive systems to produce what we produce. We also have to ship that offshore a long, long way, much further than most people on this planet. And so we need to produce, you know, the highest yields and the best quality to be able to squeeze that money by the time that we've got it overseas. And so if there's some way to reduce that amount of capital input and that amount of risk and that amount of investment, I think that's what farmers will try to look for. But it's not easy, or I think people would have done it. But I think that's why there's such interest in, say, especially intercropping as a system that maybe makes more sense at actually achieving those very pragmatic results.
It also has an impact on soil health, and I think when I think about regenerative, I see it as a paradigm rather than as a specific system, because you've got people who are practicing regenerative from an organic perspective and trying to capture a premium in the marketplace, and you have everyone right over to the no-till farmers on the other end of the spectrum that are practicing some of those principles using every technology available and accomplishing the same or pursuing the same goal, which is soil health. So it's something that probably no matter where you're at in your farming systems thinking, you could tap into some of these, like the intercropping, for example. The people that are doing it seem to be seeing some real benefits from that.
Yeah, and I think people are just really trying to find ways that make sense agronomically with the soil, and then with the economics of the markets to all fit together.
Yeah.
And they're facing real challenges just making it a pragmatic reality. Even with, we've been hearing at lots of the conferences, problems with crop insurance, right? Where, you know, your yields, if you're intercropping, are not going to be fitting the monoculture standards. And so even if you can agronomically do things, some, you know, for sensible economic reasons, it doesn't always work that way with the insurance industry. And
correct.
So there's a lot of little things to sort out here, but farmers are looking for ways. That's what I'm hearing there, is the farmers are trying to find ways.
Robert?
Yeah, one thing I've noticed is there's kind of a lack of data when it comes to regenerative agriculture.
Right.
So for example, we don't even know how many producers use cover crops. It's not like a known number. I've asked the question multiple times, well, how many people in Manitoba or Saskatchewan or Alberta practice regenerative ag? And nobody has an answer, right?
Partly because it's loosely defined.
Yeah, and the whole thing's very vague. You know, one person could define it this way or another way. But I guess for a movement to gain momentum, you need sort of those data points to understand, okay, well, is it growing? Where is it at now? Where is it going to be next year, right? So that to me, is a bit lacking right now in terms of understanding what's happening.
Bruce, what's your thoughts?
Again, I think all of the points that have been made about adaptation is sort of where everybody's at right now. A couple of things come to mind, though. First of all, we are still in this phase where we are taking a generation of older farmers that are sort of around my age and transferring operational and equity into the younger generation. And I think that's a good thing because that does bring up this idea, well, we've always done it this way in the past, but newer farmers are more likely to adapt new strategies. So I think that's very good news, and I've been very encouraged in meeting with young farmers at the meetings I was doing in November talking about issues like this. I think the second thing, and this is something a little bit more on the policy side, but in terms of the carbon tax, that's been one sort of aspect of the federal policy. But I think one of the things that we really have to take mind of right now is how does agriculture fit into the carbon plan over time here? And there's no real strategy that I perceive yet coming from the federal government. Again, our soils are a big carbon warehouse, and managing that correctly does need some incentives, and it does need some planning. So I think that's something to keep an eye on, maybe not over the next year, but over the next number of years as we move forward here, because agriculture does have a positive role to play. It seems like we get a lot of negative press in agriculture.
It's sort of portrayed as a villain or a martyr, you know, but there's still debate around that.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So we do have to figure out what the role is, and certainly I think there is a constructive role that agriculture needs to play in this whole carbon situation, carbon strategy over time.
So just as we wrap up for today, the question that I wanted to throw out is, acknowledging that we are all armchair agriculturalists, I'm not even going to call us armchair farmers, with the possible exception of Bruce, but you know, if you had one piece of advice that you could offer to our audience about 2020, what would it be? What would you tell them going forward? Bruce, let's start with you.
First off, and this may sound a little bit silly, but be optimistic, because really this has probably been the toughest year that I've seen in my years of monitoring agriculture, participating in the farm. And so I think there's only one way to go, and that's up, despite some of the concerns about next year. The other aspect on the price side, I do think we're probably not necessarily going to turn the corner here right now, but over the next few years, we'll probably get into the other part of the cycle that's far more rewarding and optimistic than the part that we're in currently.
Robert?
I guess my advice would be more for the federal government. I think it would be mostly symbolism, but I think they need to say something about what's happening with China. They need to say something about what's happening with Europe, and how the Europeans are basically refusing to buy our agricultural products, or, you know, imposing these technical barriers. Would it actually have an impact? Maybe not. But I think farmers and people in the ag community just need to hear this, that the federal government cares and is willing to say something out loud rather than always discussing these things behind closed doors. I think that's people need to hear that their government and their leaders are kind of in their corner.
Thank you. Ed White?
Yeah, I think I'd stick with that theme of being optimistic, which Bruce hit on there a couple of minutes ago. And I mentioned before the concept of the reversion to the mean, which is, you know, you can have one really bad or disappointing year and you can't see reasons to think that it'll be better this year rationally. You think, well, why would that be? Give me some reasons. But, I mean, that's exactly what tends to be the mood before things swing the other way, because stuff changes all the time. I don't think any of us back, I remember in November 2018 being downtown here in Winnipeg when all the Canadian ag interests and Jim Carr, the minister, were heading over to China for this bold new front in our trade diversification. And then a couple weeks later, Meng Wanzhou gets arrested and everything went bad. So we've had a bad year. It seemed like a disappointing year. There's no reason to believe that 2020 has to be that way. So I guess, yeah, be optimistic and just keep farming the best way you know how.
Gord Gilmore?
In preparation for the looming teenage years in my house with my daughter, I've been reflecting a lot on my father's advice. And he actually had some really good advice for challenging times for me and my siblings. And that was, sometimes you just encounter these situations where all you can do is put your head down and keep trudging. And I think this might be one of these situations. I agree with Bruce that it would be a mistake to become too pessimistic. And I guess the advice I'd give to farmers and their families is watch out for each other. You'll get through this. And it's challenging right now. There's no doubt about that, but it will get better.
Dave Bedard.
I think one more thing to add to that, too, would be just that that farmers, if they're looking for help, if they're looking for assistance, whether it be from government, whether it be just from you know, friends and family, from anybody, is that, you know, to the best of their abilities to be specific about what they need. You know, I think you know, at least at the government level, that further to what Robert was saying, is that that now would be the time really to, you know, to sort of press for programming that that would basically be of the most help. There's not going to be an election in the very near future anyway. Certainly, the federal Conservatives are in a bit of disarray right now. They've got no leader. The other parties, I don't think, can afford to you know, go back to the polls right now. And you know, it's now, I think, would be the time to approach the public sector and say, you know, look, this is what we need. And the same thing for the private sector too. Further to what we were saying about regenerative agriculture and sustainability, there's a lot of cachet right now among private companies in terms of sustainability. Right. And you know, if there's a way that farmers can sort of help these companies, you know, to reach those goals, you know, because the one thing they're finding now, a lot of these companies such as Bungie and Dreyfus and Maple Leaf, even they're finding that they can get better terms if they can demonstrably show how sustainable they're being or how sustainable their practices are. And if farmers are able to get some help for those purposes, that would be good as well.
I guess you know, thinking back, growing up on the farm, I think one of the best childhood memories I have is a 6-inch rain that happened one July afternoon in the mid-60s. And what it illustrated was that the farm was badly in need of better drainage, because all of the crops were basically a write-off that year. And I can remember my dad looking at that situation, and, you know, we were having fun playing in the ditches with all the water. And my dad looking at that situation, and my parents discussing it, and they basically loaded us up into a van and took us off to the mountains for 3 weeks. It's probably the best holiday I can remember having as a child. And their point was there was nothing to do but, you know, deal with it. And he went to work off the farm that winter to help make ends meet. But I guess if I was talking to someone on the farm, I think of all the years, this might be the year you don't think you can afford a holiday, but this is the year to take a holiday and look after the mental health of the family as best you can through times like this, because that's the biggest asset you have, really, is your own aptitude for this. So with that, I just wanted to thank Dave Bedard, Gord Gilmore, Ed White, and Robert Arneson, who are our hosts for Between the Rows throughout the year, and our special guest, frequent special guest, Bruce Burnett, to help us with weather and markets, and say Happy New Year to all of you from those of us at Between the Rows. We're reporting to you from next year country.
That's all we have for you on this week's Between the Rows, but we'll be back again next week. We hope you will be too. I'm Laura Rance.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.